I'm delighted to be joined by four passionate and very accomplished physicists who also happen to be women. The purpose of this panel is to give an idea of what physicists do and to give a flavor of the intellectual diversity within the field of physics. So I know we have quite an academically diverse audience, so if you've ever wondered what physicists do with their time, this is your chance to ask. And I know I've gotten to the end of some days and wondered what I've done with my time for the day. So first of all, I'm going to ask each of the panelists to talk a little bit about their work, and then later we'll open to questions from the floor. There's two microphones on either side of the room. You notice I'm here now, so I can't run around with the microphones anymore. So when we get to the Q&A part from the floor, if you can move to one or other of the microphones when you have a question, and we'll keep the discussion going in that way, hopefully. So I'd like to introduce our panel. We have Shampa Bhadra, who is an experimental particle physicist in the Faculty of Science and Engineering at York University. She's worked on experiments in Chicago, Fermilab, Hamburg, Zeus, and Japan, T2K. And I'll let her talk a little bit more about the physics of that. Next, we have Melanie Campbell, who is a professor in the Department of Physics in the University of Waterloo and cross-appointed to the School of Optometry. I did my PhD in quantum optics, and people call people in the field quantum opticians, so I wanted to call you an optician, but I guess that has a different meaning. So, Dr. Campbell is a fellow of the Optical Society of America and received the 2004 Rank Prize in Optoelectronics for studies of the gradient of refractive index in the crystalline lens. Shohini Ghose is an associate professor in physics and computer science at Wilfrid Laurier. She's an award-winning researcher in quantum information science and quantum chaos, and an affiliate of Perimeter Institute. She recently co-authored Canada's first introductory astronomy textbook, and she's the first director of the Laurier Centre for Women in Science. Natalia Toro is a faculty member in particle physics, theoretical particle physics here at Perimeter Institute, and is interested in physics beyond the Standard Model. Again, I'll let her talk a little bit more about the physics. At age 14, Natalia became the youngest person to win the Intel Science Talent Search. She looks like she's regretting ever putting that on a bio. And she went on to obtain her PhD from Harvard and completed a postdoc at Stanford before joining the faculty here in 2010. So I'm going to turn the floor over to our panelists. And maybe, Shampa, you can start by talking a little bit about your work. Thank you.
So I think Adriana told you about looking back 65 million years ago. Well, I look back 14 billion years ago, and we try to understand what happened after the Big Bang, and you all know about the Big Bang. So if you think about the song, you know about the Big Bang Theory, at least from the TV show. So the universe was in a hot, dense state. And so we try to recreate the environment of that hot, dense state in experiments at accelerators and laboratories. And from experiments that we have conducted, not me personally, as well, me, but other people as well, we know that the fundamental particles, so what were the most fundamental particles and what were the interactions amongst them? That's really what a high-energy physicist questions. And we know that it's made out of quarks and something called leptons, of which electrons and neutrinos are a part. Neutrinos are actually were created at the time of the Big Bang, but they should be abundantly familiar to you as products of radioactivity, but right now 65 billion are passing through your fingernail from the neutrinos from the sun. And so it behooves us to try to know something about a particle that is so abundant. But also, compared to ordinary matter, protons, neutrons, electrons, neutrinos are actually about 10 billion times more abundant. So as I said, we really should know something about the properties of these particles. So the Standard Model is the theory. Natalie works on beyond the Standard Model. I work on the Standard Model. Well, I did until neutrino properties came up. And so it is a theory of what are the most fundamental particles, these quarks, leptons, and what are the interactions amongst them. And by and large, it works beautifully. But in this model, these neutrinos that I told you about, these immensely abundant particles, they have zero mass, so zero times a lot is still zero, their contribution to the mass of the universe. And one of the biggest discoveries in the last 20 years has been that neutrinos have mass, and these are some beautifully conducted experiments down in Canada as well as in Japan. And some of you may know about the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory. And that has sort of revolutionized the way we think about these particles. And so I work at an experiment in Japan, which is at an accelerator, so we can produce the neutrinos, so we can control what they do. And last year, we actually made a measurement of the one of the last parameters that was left unknown about this neutrino. And that got some press last year as one of the very exciting results. But I'm just going to end by saying that it really affects you and me personally, because neutrinos may be the reason, one of the reasons why you and I exist as matter and not antimatter. And this is sort of the excitement that's in the field of neutrinos right now.
Thank you. Melanie?
Yes, well, I work in an area called biophotonics, which means that I do work in optics, but not quantum optics. So I work in the optics area as it's applied to biology and medicine. And in particular, I started out my career looking more theoretically and more fundamentally at problems concerning the optics of the eye. So turns out the crystalline lens of the eye, which is the second optical component, the one you can't see when you look in your eye, has a graded refractive index. And the distribution in the human lens, actually, even to this day, is under some dispute. But Maxwell first solved the distribution of the refractive index within the fisheye, looking at his breakfast herring one morning. And so I thought, well, if Maxwell was interested, maybe it's an interesting problem to solve. So I developed some experimental methods and some theoretical inversion methods to get at the refractive index distributions in other crystalline lenses as a function of growth and age. And that's how I started in the field. Started, as I said, theoretically, and then was interested in actually doing the experiments that would produce the data that I needed to do the calculations. And over the years, I've taken that knowledge of the optics of the eye and applied it more to more real-world problems. And so one of the very exciting things that's happened in my field is that we have used some methodology from astronomy, deformable mirror methodology, that allows you to correct the optics of the eye. Was used by astronomers on a very large scale, very expensive mirrors, to correct the deformations of light wavefronts that occurred due to the atmosphere, and we could take that same technology and then apply it to correcting the optics of the eye. And what that's now allowing us to do is to image the back of the eye, your retina, at a cellular level, look at individual cells at the back of your eye, and it has led to some advances and hopefully will lead to more in terms of diagnosing diseases. The current problem I'm looking at is whether we could do early diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease by looking at the back of the eye. And there are lots of other very interesting applications in terms of even therapies, light-driven therapies where you would localize the light that you're putting into the eye to apply to a photodynamic drug in a particular area that was damaged to stop there being more damage at the back of the eye. And so those are the kinds of very practical problems I'm now excited by, and that means that I'm working much more interdisciplinary area. I actually have helped build an instrument that's now at SickKids Hospital, as well as instruments in my own lab. And so I've sort of morphed from a physicist who was very interested in a particular theoretical problem to someone who sees physics as being very important to biology and to medicine on a broad scale, and some very exciting problems that you can solve. And I love crossing those interdisciplinary boundaries.
Thank you. Shohini?
Yeah, so, well, before I start, I also wanted to mention, for those who may not have been here earlier, that Sarah also is an accomplished physicist who's at Perimeter Institute, so there's 5 female physicists. I mean, that's a huge concentration. You will never see this again.
5 in one room.
So, remember
this
moment.
All the women we would meet at a quantum information conference.
So, yes, remember, we know every physicist in Canada, right? Almost. So, my area of research is quantum information science. And what that basically broadly means is that I look at how the laws of quantum physics can be used for information processing. So things like computing, building, super fast quantum computers to do specific tasks, or doing things that we've never thought of doing before, such as teleportation or secure communication. So these are some examples of potential applications of quantum physics. Personally, I'm not that interested in actually building that quantum computer. I'm a theoretical physicist, but I don't tell the funding agencies that.
It's being recorded.
Delete that part. So, but no, for me as a theoretical physicist, I'm really interested in what's quantum about that quantum computer? Should we build it? What's that power? What's the fuel? And we don't really understand that. As in what's that big difference between, you know, what we have today in terms of the, you know, classical laws of physics versus those special properties at the quantum level? You know, you may have heard of things like entanglement, which is, you know, a sort of correlation between quantum particles that enables, or we think, some of these gains in information processing speeds and efficiencies. So although I am a theoretical physicist, I do collaborate with experimental physicists to try to study some of these in actual experimental settings. So one of the things I've been working on in the past is trying to look at systems of cold atoms and try to control them using lasers and magnetic fields and observe what the quantum dynamics is of the system. And one of the things that we did was to try to observe them. I mean, an observation is a whole, you know, strange thing in quantum physics. When you observe something, you disturb it. So that's it's very hard to get information because of that. So one of the things we tried to do is, you know, create these movies of atoms, you know, undergoing some kind of quantum dynamics, and connect that to quantum properties such as entanglement. And specifically, we've looked at how those kinds of properties evolve under certain kinds of, you know, chaotic behavior. And so that was something we've been working on recently, and I'm looking at, you know, more such examples and general kinds of patterns and characteristics that we can describe about this very interesting thing called entanglement.
Thank you. Natalia.
So I guess I'll close the circle in a sense. Shantha told you quite a bit already about particle physics. I also work in particle physics, more on the theoretical side. The kinds of problems that I'm interested in are understanding the most basic constituents of matter all around the universe, looking for new kinds of particles, particles that could represent the dark matter. Most of the mass of the universe is of some type that we don't yet understand. And new particles like the Higgs boson, a wealth of different possibilities. As a particle physicist, I end up inevitably talking a lot about particles, sort of the building blocks of nature, but I think what drives me, what drives many of us, is really understanding the rules of those, how those particles fit together to make the whole story of nature. So we learn in our chemistry classes how the quantum mechanics and the connections, the spins of electrons lead to the whole structure of the periodic table and the rich possibilities there. And for me, that kind of aha moment, that there were simple rules that dictated all of this structure, was largely what brought me into physics and what continues to drive me into understanding particle physics questions. Now, what I just described is extremely broad. It's what most particle physicists work on, so maybe I'll just tell you a little bit about two of the projects that I've been involved in most recently. One on the more theoretical side is trying to understand the properties of light. One of the things we learn about light in high school is that there are two different polarizations. When you put on polarized sunglasses, if you turn two pairs of sunglasses 90 degrees from each other, you stop seeing light through. That's telling you that there's two polarizations. But is it really that there's only two polarizations that exist in the theory? Or is it that there are many polarizations of which only two interact? And so I've been trying to formulate theories where there are many polarizations but only two of them interact, see whether those theories make sense and how they can be tested. And a second area I'm very interested in is lower mass particles, things lighter than the particles that we've already understood many things about, but maybe very weakly coupled, that could give us hints of physics sort of far beyond the realm that we've imagined. And I've been fortunate to work with great groups of people on two experiments at Jefferson Lab, in the United States, one of which I'm a co-spokesperson for with some very talented experimentalists there and some fellow theorists, and then a second one that I've also been involved in looking for these light particles.
Thank you. So maybe before we open up questions to the floor, I'd also like to ask you each to maybe say a little bit about why you became a scientist and what excites you in science. You, I think, already covered this a little bit, but I'd love to hear from all of you. And then if some of you have some questions, maybe you can start making your way to the microphones.
Why I became a scientist? Mm-hmm. It was a hard choice, because I wanted to go either into music or literature or science. And, you know, so maybe people today don't really appreciate how the younger people, what choices you have. You know, when I went to university, we didn't really have a choice. I mean, ideally in today's world, I would have double majored in something, you know, if you don't have to give up something. But I think it was flip of the coin. Actually, I was told physics was easier than doing English lit.
So. Wow.
There you go. I went for the easiest path.
I haven't had many people with that impression.
No, yeah. I was told I wouldn't have to be in the library as often. So. But no, seriously. But I love science, and maybe it just won out over my other loves. So.
I was a bit the same way. My father was a physicist. As a high school student, I felt very intimidated by his knowledge compared to my very little knowledge, and so I hadn't planned to go into physics. Initially, I thought I'd be a math and economics major, and then I realized that I was much more excited by my science classes in general, and physics in particular, but I still went through another kind of morphing where I thought I was going to do physiology with a physics minor, and then just realized that it was really the physics that excited me, and that was where my passion was. It took me a while longer to decide what field of physics, and there, working in various labs, I was at the University of Toronto at the time, and I have to, you know, give thanks to all those supervisors who took me into their labs and let me try out different areas of physics, from nuclear physics to polymer physics to, you know, theoretical biophysics, so that I could finally decide which sub-area it was that my passion lay in. And that would be my advice to everybody, is go with what excites you the most, you know, what you're the most interested in, and for whatever reason, whatever it tweaks your fancy, and try to do that little bit of experimenting in terms of going out and doing a little bit in someone's lab or going off to a work position or whatever to see whether actually working in that area is what you want to do.
Thank you.
So I'll be more specific. 1984, back then I was a girl in India, and 1984, Rakesh Sharma became the first Indian astronaut in space. And I thought, wow, Indians can do science? It was really, you know, quite, like on the international stage, it was on TV and everything. So, and we went to our neighbors to actually watch it on TV because we didn't have a TV. So it was really a big event and experience, and I thought, okay, maybe this is something I should look into. I mean, that's kind of when I started thinking of it seriously, and then of course, Melanie, I realized that this is really very interesting stuff. And I like the fact that in the science classes, I didn't have to memorize as much in physics as in biology, so that helped as well. You can work things out. So, and that appealed to me a lot, I did well, and that certainly also makes it easier to keep going. And yeah, that's how it started.
Anything to add? Or? Okay, sure. Thanks. I don't think you'd find many panels where people would say, go to university and study physics because it's the least work you'll have to do.
And they lied. That's the worst part.
Right. Memorize.
Least memorization, that's true.
That's true.
So
that
many of the other courses are full of memorization, not thinking.
Huge,
right?
Biology books.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have our first question from the floor.
Hi. Great. Thank you for sharing your stories with us. And I just have one question, because for me, I'm still doing my undergrad right now. I'm currently in second year undergrad at University of Waterloo for engineering. But back from high school, I did have a lot of friends who are intimidated by the idea of physics. They think it's a very difficult subject. And even I have friends who come to university and decide to transfer from physics to engineering because they think engineering is easier in a way than physics. So I was just wondering if you have something to say to people from a younger generation, not saying you guys are old at all, but saying if you do have anything to say to people like middle school or high school, even the starting of undergraduate students, is there anything you want to say to them? Maybe try to encourage them to join the career of science and physics?
Well, I could answer that because I commented on my own intimidation because my father was a physicist and he knew it all and he had difficulty understanding why his daughter didn't get physics right away, you know, as soon as she looked at it. It should be obvious because it was obvious to him. So, you know, think of it that way, that a physicist, you know, your physics teachers or the physicists who are in graduate school, they've had a whole lot more training than you have, and you shouldn't be intimidated by the fact that you're at an earlier stage and you don't understand as much. And one very interesting thing for me was that I did quite well in high school physics, but I never thought I understood it. I always felt like I was missing pieces, and, you know, I got good marks, but it didn't seem to me that I should be getting those good marks. And then when I came to university and I started through university physics, those pieces started to fall in place for me, the pieces that were missing from the surface level you get in high school, you know. And so the more I studied it, the more sense it made to me. And, you know, there were courses I struggled with, and there were other physics students who above me who would say, well, you know, just stick with it. The light will go on at some point, and that was usually the case. Three quarters of the way through some physics course, the light bulb would start dimly in the distance, and then it would glow brighter as I got, you know, put pieces together. So those of us who are physicists have felt intimidated on occasion, and it's a subject you have to immerse yourself in and you have to stick to. But it's worth it in the end, that's what I would say, for all those light bulb exciting moments that you get from studying physics.
Does anyone want to add anything?
Yeah, well, I'll add something. From my own perspective, as a theorist especially, I think there is this perception that, you know, that held me back for a long time and that I suspect holds back a lot of young people of both genders, that you have to be the sort of Einstein figure to make any breakthroughs that matter in science, and what in physics, theoretical physics in particular. And, well, so what I say to that is I'm pretty sure that's just wrong. I'm pretty sure even Einstein did not live up to his own legend. And, you know, physics is hard. You get confused. You have to spend a lot of time going back to basics and understanding why things work a certain way, questioning your own assumptions. That's how progress is made. It's hard work, and you'd have to work hard at it. You have to really try to understand it as well as you can. But if you look back at the history of physics, most of the great discoveries have been made by people, you know, like you and me. I mean, okay, more masculine, more white, but other in terms of capability, people like you and me, going through, getting confused, getting stuck, getting themselves unstuck, and suddenly realizing a route to progress through that work. So I think somehow we need to make physics, the process of understanding physics, more approachable, more acknowledge, celebrate the mistakes that lead to progress. And hopefully that'll help people be a little less intimidated as they go into the field.
I'd like to make a comment on the experimental side too. Because I've taught students in labs at the university level for years, and I was also involved in some outreach to grade 7 and 8. There was a Science Olympics, and so I was asked to set up some optics problems for the grade 7 and 8 kids. And I have to say that if you can get over your intimidation, those kids in grade 7 and 8 who came in cold to Science Olympics and were asked to do things with light and mirrors and lenses did a whole lot better than any of my university students because they weren't intimidated. They just started to experiment. And so sometimes I think we lose that childlike ability to just play with things and see what works, and it's a shame that's lost.
I was just going to say that physics is hard, as she said. So I think it's inappropriate to expect that it's just going to come like that, and it's hard to everybody. It's hard for me every day. But I think there's a difference between being genuinely puzzled as opposed to being intimidated, and sometimes the two get mixed up. But the other thing I was going to say is people say that you actually don't learn something really until you teach it. Believe me, every day I'm learning something new by teaching a class for this first year, fourth year. So it's a long process. So I think it's inappropriate if we have given young people the idea that it's all very easy and you're just not smart enough to get it, but here I am, I understand it all. Every day I'm faced with, I don't understand it.
Yeah. I don't know if you know the story about Feynman, and a lot of people are familiar with the Feynman lectures because they were used for early undergraduates, but when he actually started lecturing to early undergraduates, his classroom was almost empty, and the people that we used to come to hear his lectures were his fellow professors, because it illuminated things about the basic subject that they had not yet understood. He had different approaches, but most of the early undergraduate students went to other people's lectures. So just, you know, we each learn differently at different stages.
Thank you for sharing your stories. And just one more question. So again, I'm just kind of coming from high school, but I'm thinking from your perspective, is there any way perhaps you change the curriculum physics that will make kids more interested and not be, you know, scared of, intimidated of the area you're currently studying in? Anyone?
Can I just address, as part of my committee work, my department. I was looking at exactly what's taught in high schools. I hope nobody's going to be offended, but I think the curriculum is a bit crazy. It's just a lot of things that are thrown at you instead of trying to have you understand some things well and really. And once you get confidence in one thing, you feel that you can understand the rest. But it's a crazy mix of a whole bunch of things that are thrown. Where some of the things I read the titles, and even my fourth year students don't really understand them very well. So I think the curriculum is actually partly at fault. Why it is that that plus my pet peeve that high school, I think at high school and under at elementary school, it needs to be taught by someone, not necessarily the most brilliant person on this planet, but someone who has a passion for the subject. And sometimes the people who teach it themselves are intimidated by the subject, and that fear gets transmitted to the student.
I'd like to add to that and say that I would love to see more physics taught in science classes at the elementary grade levels, because I think very often what happens is that biology is seen as a simpler science to teach, and so that's what's taught in elementary school. And so you miss that period where students really can grasp. I mean, I was taught new math back in the old days in grade 5, and you know, set theory and all kinds of things. And the students in grade 5 didn't find it difficult at all. The teachers found the new math more difficult than the students. I'd really like us to move more physics principles and experiments back into primary school, but that requires knowledgeable teachers, and that unfortunately just doesn't happen at that level, that you have teachers who've been that exposed to physics.
Thank you.
Yep, do we have a question there?
Thank you all very much.
Can you just check on the top if that's switched on? I'm not sure if, is there a light on? Okay, yeah.
So thank you all very much. I'm thinking about your experience, all of you, as having successfully navigated the collection of factors that Dr. Ivy was talking about in her talk, thinking about it from an institutional perspective. So some of the factors that the evidence is very suggestive, at least, are in play here, are things that can't be remedied within institutions, things like the social availability of spouses who will take on a disproportionate amount of the work of running a household. That's not a decision, say, that a dean can issue an edict and remedy, but some of the factors plausibly are there to be addressed or mitigated institutionally in knowledge-producing institutions, whether it's universities or institutes. So I was curious whether you had thoughts about ways that institutions, as given your experience with them, things that they could do to ensure that some of the differences of degree that Dr. Ivy was talking about don't turn into more discrete or sharp differences. So for instance, tenure was one of the factors that was mentioned. I don't know if there are others, or if you have personal insights from having negotiated your way through the system, you could say that to add to the recommendation slide, basically, of the previous talk.
Okay, who wants to start?
I could start on that. I have thought about about some of these issues. And I was telling some people at lunchtime, I first became involved with some of these issues because at the time that I had my second child, I was on an NSERC University Research Fellowship. So I phoned NSERC to say, I'm going to be taking a maternity leave, you know, what are your rules? And there was dead silence at the other end of the line. And what the staff member said to me was, gee, we hardly ever have women on these fellowships and no one's ever got pregnant before. So, no, we don't have a policy. Now, the outcome was quite positive from my point of view because they basically allowed me to negotiate my own maternity leave, although in those days you couldn't stop the clock, and my committee, my grantsmanship committee, complained about not enough bang for their buck, so they were still playing my fellowship, but I was on leave, so they didn't get any bang for the buck. That was in quotes on my report on my for my renewal, but I did get renewed, and NSERC put me on their policy committee to give input into these issues. So they then educated me because they had all of these surveys and reports, and they understood the importance of role models, they understood the importance of maternity leaves and parental leaves. So I really was educated through that process on that committee, and have then tried to apply some of that within my own institution, University of Waterloo. I was on the committee that recently, within the last few years, negotiated parental leaves for both males and females. And I'm currently working on a committee that's working on issues around hiring and how do you do better hiring, and we're relying on some of Carla's expertise in that. So I think, you know, it is important to think about the issues and to try to make the place a better place. And if I have to do administrative work, which I have to do, I always like to choose things that I feel I can make an impact at. And so these are some of the issues that maybe I can make a difference from personal experience. So yes, I'd like to see hiring that recognizes implicit bias and tries to do the best to create bigger pools of applicants, more outstanding applicants. I think a friendlier workplace with parental leaves and maternity leaves leads to hiring of better candidates and better retention by the university. So I think I agree with Carla and other things that were said here today that it makes the place better for everybody, not just for the women. And so I feel quite strongly about that and would say, for all those policies that have been discussed and all those barriers, as more and more men become involved with child rearing, as you said, you know, some of them begin as supportive spouses, some of them don't, but it's going to make their lives better too, to have these systemic things addressed and to make for a friendlier, better workplace.
So every institution should have a Center for Women in Science. That's my recommendation. But seriously, it does help to have official, institutional sorts of organized structures that are public, that are, you know, as high profile as possible, because that raises awareness. And what we've noticed in our center, and we've only been in existence for a few months, is that it really gives a voice to our students too. They are very much involved. They feel somehow now that they have identity, and they get to create and develop that identity in the way they want. So, you know, they have full autonomy within certain limits to take this in whatever direction they like, and that's really an important thing. So, yes, in some sense, you know, institutional resources is very, very important. It has to be official, it has to be public, and it has to be, you know, strong, not just in saying, oh yes, we promote it, and not do something about it.
Add anything?
Yeah, I'll just echo a lot of what Melanie said. I think the having an open and very well-advertised policy towards things like parental leave, delaying tenure clock, parental leave at all levels, not just faculty, postdocs, graduate students, is really important, not just for the individuals who are using it at any given time, but for everybody coming into the institution to see and to be consciously reminded that allowing everybody, regardless of their stage of life, regardless of how much of their responsibility parenting is a welcome part of that institution, of that intellectual community. I don't have kids, I can do physics 24/7 if I want to, because my husband is also a particle physicist. I am right now the ideal worker, But making a workplace that is welcoming of people who do not fit the ideal worker profile but can contribute great ideas to the institution is incredibly valuable, and making that sort of open and transparent. And the second thing I'd highlight is the pervasiveness of biases in hiring. I mean, I was shocked when I first came into a position of reviewing applications at the biases I kept catching in my own thinking, at the biases I strongly suspected in reading many recommendation letters, where women and men with about the same credentials, somehow the men always seemed to be described using stronger, more positive words for the same qualities, and the women with less positive affirmations of that quality. I think that's something that all of us at any institution need to be much more educated about than we are. And I've thought less about workplace culture, about making it a welcoming place for the people who are already at an institution, but I think that is vital.
Can I just pick up on something you said? One of the things you both of you were talking about was, for example, I learned at lunch about a rule about post-pregnancy, and I think honestly that some of the chairs or deans are unaware of many of these rules. I think maybe some, it would go a long way towards sort of giving people a pamphlet saying, these are the rules that you need to be aware of and follow up. They're not maybe all deliberately, you talked about bias, etc. Some people are just actually unaware of it. And there was something else that you just talked about that I wanted to touch upon. What was the other thing you said at the end?
Bias in hiring.
Biases in hiring. Oh yeah, sorry, about reading letters. You just brought to mind something. I was on a committee as well recently, and it was on somebody's tenure file, and it was an outstanding candidate, and the reviewer said it was an outstanding candidate, and then proceeded to compare this person with some other females, and the candidate was a female. What did this, and we spent the next 10 minutes discussing, what did this have to do with anything, right? This person should be reviewed in their own, but that's exactly what was, this person showed bias without perhaps intending to, probably thought that it was doing this person a great favor, but the reviewer was not doing this person a great favor. So it's just inherent biases that are so deeply built in that need to get addressed.
So overall, it seems people mentioned parental leave and educating people about unconscious bias, I guess. Anything else to add? Okay, shall we move on?
So I guess sort of following up on the previous person's question about, not following up, in reaction, like when we go to do physics, this intimidation that might occur, right? A lot of it's our choice about what attitude to take. And so, when you see a problem you cannot solve, do you get excited? Does it make you want to do it more? Or are you just say, I cannot do it because, it doesn't occur to me now because I'm stupid already, kind of put those hats on yourself. And, for me personally, if I think I can solve all the problems with physics and can answer all the questions, I don't want to be doing it, right? Somehow the choice of attitudes, maybe you guys can, you ladies can elaborate on it and kind of tell the younger generation how they might want to train themselves to react like psychologically when they encounter difficulties and what.
Do you want to?
I still get some problems that I get intimidated by, but there are other really hard problems that I'm really excited by, so. Yeah, I have both reactions, probably in my case, depending on the time of day. So if I encounter a really difficult problem that I'm struggling with at night, I'm smart enough to know that I work better in the morning, so I'll just go to bed and try it again the next morning. And I guess that's what you learn about yourself. You learn, if you leave it aside for a while, and I'm also one of those people, and I suppose I sometimes think this comes from having children, but who works on things in the shower. And I used to say that was the only time when I had two young children, that was the only time I got to think, right, was in the shower. So yeah, I'll often find myself going through something in the shower in the morning rather than with a pencil and a piece of paper. So again, you know, I leave it at the back of my mind for a little while and then I go back to it more seriously after I've left it alone for a while. But everybody has to develop their own ways of approaching difficult problems.
So just to add to that, one thing that has been studied a lot recently is self-perception about our own abilities, you know, and the differences in gender. And so, yeah, what it shows is that we are hard on ourselves and we get easily discouraged. So it's one thing I would say is have more faith in yourself. So when you start a problem and you get stuck or so on, you know, it's important to step back a little and then come back. You know, it's okay if you can't solve it the first time. The other thing, and a big strategy that, you know, I've learned with experiences, you know, it's important to talk to others about it. More and more, we are talking about research projects and problems that are collaborative, and they actually cross disciplines a lot more. So I think that's really important, and it takes time to learn how to speak other people's languages and, you know, take that first step, and it's hard. But, you know, it takes a little bit of time and experience. And the third thing is, you know, part of getting stuck is, you know, you have to learn what's the other approach you might be able to take. And again, that comes from, I think, you know, experiences. It's sort of like, you know, when you do homework problems and, you know, you get stuck and then you got to go back and figure out what was the problem and work it out. But, yeah, those would be some comments.
Yeah, I think, again, I mean, this is a theme I mentioned earlier, but When you get stuck, there's two kinds of points of view. Either I'm stuck, and if I get through this, maybe I'll discover something extraordinary, or I'll learn something that's known, but that I've never really understood before, versus I'm stuck, surely nobody else would be as stuck as I am. I must not be cut out for this work. Yeah. And it's that second one that's really debilitating, right? I'm stuck, I must be inadequate for this work. And again, I think for me, when I feel that way in my research, I find reading the history of physics very therapeutic. I find it just incredibly reaffirming to remember that Maxwell didn't understand electromagnetic waves. That the first person to really try to understand electromagnetic waves in Maxwell's theory, Fitzgerald, proved they didn't exist a decade before he realized that they did exist and properly understood them. And I think also, though, in our as role models to younger physicists, there's a danger that as we share our excitement about our successes, we tend to airbrush out some of the wrong turns that we took along the way. And I think if young people approaching physics only see the successes, only see the most direct path to the right answer, and not all the showers that just ended up in wrong ideas, they get a false impression of how they compare to the more experienced colleagues.
I want to return, though, to this theme that was mentioned, that women can be harder on themselves. And it's come up in a couple of places today that, you know, there are fewer women applying to the PSI program, but those that are of high caliber. And in my own experience, that's true too, so that when I went to U of T as a physicist, physics student, undergraduate, there were very few females in my class. But on graduation, three of the top five spots were held by females. So I always worry about all the females who get discouraged and don't do physics, because only, you know, it seems like you have to, in order not to give up as a female, you have to be better than average, right? Whereas for males, if they're average, they can still go into physics. And so I don't know how to address it, but it's a very real concern, I think, that we are missing out on women who actually could do physics but become discouraged early, think they're not good enough, are harder on themselves than the males are. And I still see it among my students, both undergraduate and graduate students, that the females tend to be harder on themselves than the males. And some of the males tend to be overconfident compared to the abilities they have. Others are not. But So what do we do about that? And I don't have an answer for that one, and worry that even by the time girls get into undergraduate physics, that we've left behind a number who would actually be very good physicists.
Thanks. Is there a question?
And Maxwell can't help me here. I was glad to hear somebody talking about the history of physics, because I've been reading a very good biography about Isaac Newton by a man named Westfall. Isaac Newton did not learn physics. He found it out. He was not taught by anybody. He taught himself. You will, I take it, accept the fact that Isaac Newton was one of the great physicists as well as one of the great mathematicians. So it might be encouraging to people to realize that he is somebody who did it himself. Nobody taught him. And when I hear about institutions, you know, doing things, I say, well, Isaac Newton was at Trinity College, Cambridge, and he didn't learn anything there. He didn't. Didn't even. And who was it? Somebody mentioned Einstein gave lectures on physics and people couldn't understand it.
Feynman.
Who?
Feynman.
Richard Feynman.
Feynman. I don't understand the name. What's his name?
Richard Feynman.
Oh, Feynman. Yes, Richard Feynman. Well, Newton had to give lectures as a Lucasian professor of physics, and people would wander in and they'd wander out. He had I think there was only one man who even stayed because they couldn't understand him. Anyway, I wanted to, somebody was mentioning the history of physics, and I just throw that out to you. Now there's something else that is of concern to me, which is that boys have been being discouraged because of the push for women everywhere. And I've heard about this from people in education right here in Waterloo. There are fewer boys going into college than girls.
Actually, I don't think it's linked to women. As my understanding, it's linked to teaching styles which don't have the diversity that they need to have in order to teach the full range of women and men, or boys and girls. And that was what I was going to say in response to your comment about Newton, too. There are a wide range of learning styles that different people have. I had two daughters, and they had extremely different learning styles, so I had to go out and find out about that. And it seems that sometimes the education that we give in public and high schools is not well matched to the learning styles of a lot of the boys. And so it's not because we're pushing girls extra hard, it's because the styles are just not well matched. And I think we have to do more to create a place where you're teaching, where you're actually teaching using a number of styles so that you hit on everybody's favorite learning style, whether they're like Newton and want to go away and learn it on their own, or whether they need to hear it verbally, whether they are kinesthetic learners and need to get the hands-on experience. We just need to be more diverse in our teaching styles.
Thank you. So maybe, do we have another question?
Can interact or get aggravated by other type of biases or stigma, such as race or background, all of these things.
So the question is how different biases interact and aggravate one another?
Yeah, how do you think that other type of stereotypes or like society labels may aggravate or ease or change or interact with the gender bias we see in science?
Well, I think there's a ton of interaction, and this as well as the last question is a good is a good opportunity to emphasize that, you know, even as we are here, in some sense, a rather monochromatic group of five women talking about challenges in physics, there are, you know, there are a lot of other different obstacles that people face coming from different aspects of their backgrounds. Race, early access to education, class, family expectations in different cultures, medical challenges, I mean, all of these things are huge. And we need to, you know, we need to think about all of them. And I think many of the solutions that we've talked about, that what's been emphasized throughout the day is that these are not solutions just for women, these are solutions for equity across the board. Making more access to mentorship through official designated channels will not just help connect women, it'll help connect people from racial minorities, from cultural minorities who might not get the same access to mentorship.
And there was a comment made earlier in the day about diversity and how diversity contributes to innovation and to discovery. And I think that that's true, and I think that that's diversity in its broadest sense, not just gender diversity, but diversity of backgrounds, diversity of thinking, diversity of approach, interdisciplinary nature. That's what's believed to be one of the keys to discovery, and so encouraging a diverse workplace, it helps everybody and helps the workplace to advance.
So I believe the question was about whether, if I heard correctly, if cultural differences played into gender bias or not. And just from my personal experience, I went to the States for graduate school, and I was the, which is, you know, States, it's not India, and I was only a female graduate student, I think, within 4 years, basically, below and above, sort of. But when I was in India, in high school, you know, like you were saying, the first top three people within the top 10 have graduated in that whole state, five were girls, and they all went on to become actually engineers and mathematicians, etc. And but then when I was in university, they were 25% of the class was so. You know, preconceived notions sometimes can get turned on its head as well. But I went to a conference, and I don't know if it's still true, but I certainly worked with a lot of Italian graduate students in my, because I work in these huge collaborations, so nearly every nationality is represented. And it was very interesting because there were a lot of Italian female graduate students, but Italy, I don't know if it's still true, but there's a ceiling. You know, they never make it, very few of them make it to professorial level, etc., but they're and there was a lot big discussion on exactly why this was so, and I'm not even going to pretend that I remember a lot of the details of that. But I know for a fact, I know a large number of the Italian physics community, and nearly, I think besides two people, they're all men. So there's something, there is a cultural bias, obviously, to this.
Thank you. Is there another question?
So you've all talked at some point or another about what it's like to get stuck and the way that you kind of work past that. And I'm kind of curious because we give a lot of attention to kind of the light bulb illumination moment of trading ideas, and especially in physics where it's so hard for people outside the discipline to really understand what's going on in a physicist's job. Could you, some of you, talk about when you, because like we have a better idea of what, say, it looks like to work hard at painting or kind of other disciplines, when you sit down at your desk to work on physics, what does the hard work of physics look like?
It's a great question, thank you. Who wants to take a shot at this?
Well, they work at desks.
Yeah, we don't have to go in the lab. So. I just find a nice beach, you know, or something. Get my books out. No, so, well, my own area involves a fair amount of numerical simulations as well as model building. So, you know, typically I would, you know, take whatever is the specific problem and, you know, the first step, of course, is building the model, which involves creating some, developing some equations that would adequately describe the model, taking into account all the parameters of the problem, in my own case, I work specifically at modeling, you know, as I said, atomic systems. So there's a fair amount of physics there that is known. So, you know, I use the background, and I think that's an important part. You know, there's always some literature search to be done. You know, you got to know what's already out there, and then how it fits into the particular model you want to study, and then build that model with the right parameters, knowing, in my case, I have to know experimental parameters that I can fit in there. And, you know, then there is a whole component of numerical simulations in my case, and there's always going to be, you know, I guess what is the hard part is, do you believe your results, right? That's always, you know, a tough thing to do, especially if it's, you know, big, giant, complicated numerical simulations. So I know that I've had, well, recently there was a paper which we published where the first time I saw the data, I'm like, this is so wrong. It didn't make any sense. So that means go back, check, try to find different ways of calculating the same thing. And, you know, in that case turned out it was actually correct. And that's always a nice moment when something is surprising, it doesn't make sense, and it turns out to be correct, is actually neat. So that was nice because that's a surprising result is usually a fun result. Yeah, and I guess that's broadly how it works.
Yeah, I mean, in my more recent theoretical work, I think that there have been sort of two modes of hard work. The first is coming into my office every morning for a week, staring at a blank piece of paper, having a problem I want to solve, and I really don't know how to solve the problem, and I just have to force myself. If I just stare, if I just think in a blank thoughts, I'm going to get nowhere. And just trying to force myself to go through, to find some calculation that'll shed some light on the you know, on the question I want to answer, and realize that actually the calculation I was trying to do is not going to give me an answer that makes sense, or for some reason it wasn't valid, and then I have to start try again the next day. And this can go on for a long time, just trying to find the right end to a problem. So that's one kind of hard work that I've encountered recently. Yet another one is, you know this is important, and you know it will take pages and pages of math, and you have to get every sign right in your calculation. And this, yeah. If you're like me and mess up your signs, you know, even a quarter of the time, you add that up over 20 pages, and that's a real problem. So, you know, really being careful, really being systematic, and just grinding through something. It's a little more like maybe, you know, practicing a repetitive motion, like lifting weights for your athletic work. In more experimental contexts, it can mean, you know, running an experiment and you're on call for 22 hours a day, and somehow with only those 2 hours of sleep, you have to be making important decisions on a short time scale. You have to be managing other people, and it's just a very intense working environment. So broad spectrum, but those are a few examples of what it means to work in physics.
Do you want to say something about
I'm sort of in between two of them. So I'm an experimentalist, so when the theorist has a great idea after having done those many, many calculations, so I'm one of those people that actually have to then figure out if they're right or not, or we have ideas ourselves, or we just run the experiment and try to look for results. So I am at the other end of the spectrum where we have huge collaborations because they're complex devices, and they need large numbers of people to actually build these things because they're huge. So it involves, it may involve 10 years of thinking about it to get the accelerator to be built, and another maybe 5 years to build it, another 10 years to actually take the data. So you can imagine everything in between. We work with engineers to think of, well, I'm going to make this part of this huge complex device. How do I design it? How do I build it? How do my students, I used to actually be very good at computing, but now I can't compute out of a paper bag. Yes. So that's why I have smart students. But they do simulations. They do, for example, optical simulations. If I'm building an optical component, then they'll test, and then we'll put this small version of this in a test beam. And we'll see if the, if possible, then we'll see if the small version makes sense. And if it does, then we'll build a large version and put it in the experiment. And then we collect data. And the data is basically, we need that because from these interactions are, so in particular one I'm looking at right now, we have neutrinos, that would be man-made neutrinos, and they hit a large amount of material, and they need a large amount of material because neutrinos are the property that they really, really don't want to interact, and you know this because I just told you there's 65 billion going through your fingernail, and you know your fingernail hasn't disintegrated or anything. So you need to put a large amount of material in, and then you look through electronic devices, the signatures, and you've got to record those signatures through, as I said, electronic devices, and then you've got to make sense of those electronic messages, and so that takes a lot of computing. So after you've finished the building and you've stuck it into the lab and the data is being taken for many, many years, then you're actually, most of the time, people just see you hunched at your computer or hunched over your student's computer more often. And they're just sifting through all this data to try to come up with the analysis that will take you to the path that, for example, either confirms a theory or measures one parameter that has not been measured by doing a particular kind of analysis.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm between the two as well. I'll spend, my students will spend, a fair amount of time aligning optics. Like, that's a really time-consuming, careful thing to, because we're working to submicron scale in terms of correcting wavefronts. So that alignment has to be extraordinarily precise, and it can take, you know, a week to align a piece of apparatus and then test it and get it running. Then we generate a huge amount of data when we start taking data, because we're usually taking some kind of image, and you can image for 30 seconds and 30 frames a second, and suddenly you've got huge numbers of frames, even for a short experimental time. So we do spend time also talking about which experiments are most important. So we'll get together as collaborators and students, and we'll sit in a room and we'll trade ideas and with a blackboard as to where, which experiment do we think is the next most important one to do in light of what other people have done recently, you know, which is going to illuminate the right direction, which is going to give the next pointer to the answer to what's actually happening. And so that's really important work as well. And then there's looking at that data, spending time in front of the computer looking for patterns in after the analysis is done, looking, you know, in my case, because we do experiments on people, we can also do statistical analysis of if we've changed the conditions, is the difference significant statistically? And so you're looking for all those patterns. You've got a lot of students who are generating all those patterns, but, you know, I end up being the one who eyeballs the patterns, trying to look for something new, something that we can analyze a slightly different way to illuminate the answer. And then you try to bring it all together in some kind of model, some kind of theory. So again, you're sort of trying to, I guess physics is very much a science of trying to take something very complicated and simplify it down to its simplest components. And so when you finally get to that part where you're actually simplifying things down to its essence, that's when it gets most exciting, but you've looked at an awful lot of data before that. You've looked at an awful lot of possibilities before you can finally simplify things down.
Thanks, great question. Do we have another? Yep.
Could you please share with us some of the memory of some of the happiest or most exciting times you have had with physics?
This sounds like a great way to finish. We're almost out of time. So. Who wants to go first? None.
Trying to choose the one.
Well, when we made this discovery, we actually, there was a parameter we were measuring, which is related to the last thing I said about the why you and I exist here. And if this parameter turned out to be zero, then it was just very hard for us to move to the next step of figuring out this matter-antimatter asymmetry. And nobody knew whether it was going to be zero, or it was going to be a relatively large number, or it's going to be, you know, what. And our experiment actually, you know, the thrill, the joy, when we actually sifted to this data, and unfortunately, my experiment was in Japan, and there was an earthquake, as you all know, and our data, unfortunately, just stopped short of being able to make what we call a 3-sigma significant discovery, and it was just short of that, but it was exciting enough that all over there, it was newspaper articles everywhere about how every, you know, physicists believed it, and that it must be, it's, if it was true, then it was just going to really make things really exciting in the new field of neutrino physics. Of course, then we came back online after having fixed things, and we know it to be true, and another experiment confirmed it as well. But it was just such an exciting time. You know, buzz among 500 physicists when this result came out.
Nice. Couple for me. One, when we were trying to image individual cells at the back of the eye, and we did it for the first time, and we did it on a fish that someone had picked up in biology, and we stuck in a fish tank, and it shouldn't have worked. And it was just one of those times where the experiment worked the first time, and it was like, wow, you know, that was easy. And you know, it was the beginning of a long series of other experiments on finally imaging humans, but I think we went out and had a glass of champagne that day, because it was just, you know, we knew it had implications for what we were going to do in the future. And when we were looking at the gradient of refractive index in the crystalline lens, and one of my postdocs had suggested the experiment of trying to see if we could modify it by the raising conditions, again, it was on tropical fish in this case, and raising them in different lighting conditions, and could we actually change the distribution of the gradient in the optics. And, you know, the day we realized that we had actually changed that distribution just through the rearing conditions, that was another moment. The most recent one was, again, a student, and students' ideas are, you know, really important, and in this case it was an undergraduate student, and she wanted for her fourth year research project to look at Alzheimer's disease and whether you could do something in the eye. And she knew about some previous work in that crystalline lens, and I said, well, I thought that had got to the company stage, and it wasn't really the project for us. And so we talked back and forth until we came up with the right project, which was to look at the retina in the eye and see if we could find the amyloid beta. And again, you know, relatively quickly we found it where we had postulated it would be. We found it in a couple of retinas from people who had died of Alzheimer's disease, and then didn't find it in the age match controls. And that was a really satisfying moment to do that.
Very nice.
So one that I remember is actually my very first actual research project, which was an undergraduate summer project. And it was, you know, a small calculation of, in cavity QED, calculating G2, it was a number. But it was the first time that I could calculate something all the way to the end and got a number. And it was just, even, it was not even new, because it was reproducing something that was already known, because that's how you usually start. So I did it, and then I jumped around the whole room, and I got an answer. So I'll always remember that, because it gave me a lot of confidence, I guess. But more recently, as I was mentioning, I've been working on and collaborating with an experimental group to try to image atoms and try to see the connection between chaos and entanglement. In these atomic systems, and so we had developed these movies, which, you know, well, it's on the computer. These are reconstructions of this atomic wave function, and we see this them, you know, floating around and doing this interesting chaotic kind of motion, and that was really amazing to see that for the first time. So that was great.
Yeah, so I think I had almost as much excitement about the exact same calculation as Shohini when I was a graduate student.
It's a great calculation.
And aside from that, I mean, well, so I've been thinking a little bit since you asked the question. Many of my most exhilarating moments in theory have actually turned out to be premature excitement about things that turned out to be wrong. And where I thought I had a really great idea and was ready to break out the champagne, the right answers have tended to come through a little more slowly. And although they're still very rewarding, I don't get that same, I don't know if I've gotten that same thrill as I did when I was actually mistaken. But I think overall, actually, the thing that I've found most rewarding, which was maybe a little surprising to me, was actually just the great teams of people and the exhilaration, the sense of common adventure that I've encountered either in collaborating with experimentalists or as a spokesperson for this small, very intense experiment, you know. I mentioned that it was very hard work, but it was also just fantastically rewarding to see things go from a little idea to real experiment that could tell us something about nature at the end of the day, to work with a fantastic set of people with completely different skills than mine and put them together in a way that, that really advanced the field. And so I think that, that to me, the sort of the common esprit de corps and the collaboration with very different, very intense groups of people is probably one of the things I've enjoyed the most about the field.
And I think that's a great way to finish. So let's thank all our panelists for sharing with us.